Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Let's talk a bit about your background in the industry first.
Right. Both of my parents were actors. My mother in the 30s did a lot of movies. She was a star at MGM, and my father was a star throughout his Hollywood career, and then he starred on Broadway for many years. He won the box office award in 1936 because he was the first Texas Ranger, Bob Tex Allen, and he died at 93, many, many years later, at the end of the 20th century, after 3 months after he'd just given an award to Chuck Norris, who was the last Texas Ranger. So it was a nice completion of all things that that had started back in the 30s when the good guys wore white hats and they couldn't even kiss the horse, let alone the girls. So those were the good old days.
And you yourself have worked on both sides of the camera.
Well, I grew up with, you know, and any time you're in an acting family, that's part of your DNA, and you had to make ends meet when he wasn't on Broadway starring in Annie Mame or Showboat or whatever else. But that was never something that I thought was as winsome. Of course, I funded 5 feature films after I got out of law school, and I never thought that was very exciting, and we've just had another film that came together. Only because it's so rooted in Christianity and faith and values that there were 2 films that I said, well, I'm going to break my rule of not getting into film finance. But most of what we do now is back in the late 70s, I was head of the organization that did the animated version of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe on CBS television. I had come to Christ when I was 28, late in life. I'm now 63, so you can do the math. And I went to a seminary, and they elected me to be head of the organization that did The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and I won an Emmy Award, and the guys, their sons live in Australia, right outside of Sydney. Tim Gresham lives right there, but Doug and the people on the board of the C.S. Lewis said, we want to do it as a movie, and it had taken 26 years as a television program. I said, if it takes 26 years as a movie, I'm going to be 60 by the time it gets on the air. So I said, how can we help, and I was 60 when it came out as a movie, I said, how can we help more people to get into the industry so we're not just doing one every few years? The average movie in Hollywood takes 13 years. Mm. So we do a lot to try to encourage people. We give out a $50,000 prize every year for first-time screenwriters. We'd love to have screenwriters from Australia apply who have faith and values in their scripts. We've got some people connecting with us from New Zealand, but we just love to have people from all over the world. And the good news about that is not just the prize, but the scripts are read by the heads of the studios. So this year's winner, who got their award on February 11th, got a call from a studio just a month ago saying that they wanted to pick it up. So the average 13-year process for development of the script is cut short by that. And then I just took some of our Movie God Award winners, the Epiphany Prize, Michael Landon Jr., and a couple of others, the head of ABC, to Santa Fe, New Mexico, to talk to screenwriters about how they can improve their craft. So we do a lot of things to encourage people to get into the industry, and a lot of the people we encourage are not people of faith and values, but we're trying to show them that faith and values do better at the box office.
One of the ways that I guess you've really had a big impact in getting this message across is your Movie Guide Review magazine in the 80s, and it's developed now into a popular website and a TV show. What does that aim to do?
Well, Movie Guide has 2 things, and most of them come back to during the golden age of Hollywood in the 30s, 40s, and 50s when, you know, the good guy did wore white hats. Mr. Smith went to Washington. It was a wonderful life. In those days, the church was very effective and impactful and prominent behind the scenes in Hollywood. It had no power to censor. It couldn't tell anybody not to do something, but it did have a tremendous voice through the Protestant Film Office. And one of the tools they used were reviews. We do the reviews to do the same thing. We collect data, and the data shows us what's hot at the box office and what's not. And quite often, that data cuts through a lot of misperceptions. When we started doing the calculations and did our first report to the entertainment industry in 1991, the myth was that R-rated films did better at the box office. Consistently, we've shown that they do not do as well, and that doesn't mean we don't like Some of them, you know, some of them are great. Some of them we've given Movie God awards to, including Schindler's List and Amistad and of course, The Passion of the Christ. But they're, by and large, they're movies that exclude part of the audience. And we've shown what does do well. For instance, movies with strong Christian content last year averaged $44 million on average at the box office, and movies with anti-Christian content averaged $1.7 million. And overseas, it's the same thing. We even find in countries that you don't expect that movies with strong Christian faith and values do better in China, better in the Muslim countries. So it's quite incredible. And we do those numbers. So that's one of it. And the other thing we do is to try to help parents teach their kids to be media wise. We don't do thumbs up or thumbs down. What we try to do is present what the worldview is, what the language, the sex, the violence, or the lack thereof in a great movie like Up, and try to help people understand what's, you know, how to make wise decisions. So we're giving them the information they need to choose the good and reject the bad.
It's interesting you mentioned the church's involvement in the early days and in the 60s as well, but that did change. The churches withdrew their involvement from the motion picture code. Why did that happen?
Well, I can give you the precise reason, but I'll give leading up to it. The church was fracturing. The church lost its desire to be involved in the cultural mandate. But the precise reason was that in the mid-60s, the Southern Baptist Church, which is one of the more faithful churches, was having its fourth breakaway movement. The breakaway was from people who were in the Independent Baptists who thought that you shouldn't dance, sing, or go to movies, or go out with girls who did, or whatever that line is. And so they decided that they were going to, the Southern Baptists decided they had to garner and cover and protect their flank. And the way they did that is with drawing from the Protestant Film Office. They were about 60% of the funding of the Protestant Film Office. And when the conservatives left, the liberals who were remaining, who actually had gone along for a long time with it, decided to shut it down, and it wasn't important anymore that they should be just concerned with more of the liberation theology type procedures. So quickly, we went in 1966 from having 100% broad audience movies that any child could go to, even though it might be a tough theme, it didn't have exploitive material in it, to 82% restricted movies, to movies with sex and Satanism, and all the things that people complain about today. So the onslaught was basically because the conservative churches left the mission field.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned some amazing statistics in your book. The average child sees 40,000 hours of entertainment media by the age of 17. And this is scary, up to 1.5 million acts of violence. Now, how does this sort of input affect a young person's thinking?
I am so glad you said that, because every year we get all the statistical evidence from the different research organizations, and it's incredible. And you know this, people know this just from their own common sense and their interaction with their children, whereas children used to be just watching TV or going to movies. Now they're multitasking. They're watching TV, probably listening to music on their iPod, working on their iPhone, and I don't know when they're doing their homework, but they're certainly distracted by all that. So it's a serious situation, and I get a lot of calls from teachers. I'm chairman of the Electronic Media Department, Center for Art, Religion, and Education, Graduate Theological Union, Berkeley. There's a tremendous amount of concern about education and what's happening to children, not because it's all bad, but because they're so distracted from being able to apply themselves. In fact, University of Indiana did a study that said if you take children off the media for 3 days, their test scores on one of the standardized tests we use in the United States, the college boards, for the average child went up by 100%, by 100 points, 100 points, not 100%. It's an 800 scale. So it went 100 points, which is a tremendous increase. So you need to think about if your children are studying or whatever, just giving them some time off from all of the media. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm trying to put down the media. You know, I'm not trying to say, because I'm involved in the media. If you turned off the internet and everything, you wouldn't see Movie God. But I do believe that we need to be much more careful about how we spend our time. And my children have now decided they could read the best 100 novels of all time. They've made a bet that one of them can win this dare. So I think that there are other things that children could do with their time besides spending 63,000 hours with the media.
Absolutely. In your reviews, you've panned a lot of films with non-biblical worldviews, including Harry Potter, Kingdom of Heaven, Da Vinci Code. But some people would argue that Christians should go and see films that don't match their values so they can better understand the culture they live in. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, this is a myth perception that we have, and I say the word myth intentionally instead of misperception. We know a lot about how people react to films, and I'll have to take you through that quickly, and I'll try to be as succinct as possible. Mm-hmm. One of our senators, Lieberman, is on a cause about the media, says there have been 350,000 studies of the media. I'm sure he's right. I'm sure there are more than that because every film department and every media department in the world is doing studies on the impact of the media. In fact, we just are conducting with the Templeton Foundation a mega study to bring all these studies together to help them. Now, out of that 350,000 studies, there has only been one study in the mid-80s that said that the media did not have some sort of a negative effect, and that was in Canada, and it was made by the major was funded by the major networks. So one versus 350,000 is a pretty paltry example. So most people, you know, but when you say that the media has a negative impact, what do you mean by that? You have to see that children go through stages of development. When they're 3 to 7, let's say, just one of the stages, one of the 5 stages, they're in the imagination stage. That means that their imaginations are very big and they're unable to differentiate often between fact and fiction. They'll see a movie like Jaws, and there's a wonderful study from University of Wisconsin about this from a friend of mine, Professor Cantor, who's Jewish, not Christian, and just showing that kids who saw Jaws at a young age later in life had a phobia about sharks. When they did the studies at University of Wisconsin 20 years later, they were saying that they were imagining, now Wisconsin is in the middle of America, so it's landlocked. They were saying that they thought that they would take their swimming test in the pool and a shark would come along. They just had these irrational fears. We know that children in the imagination stage are very vulnerable picking up their scripts of behavior. Now, not every child is susceptible to the same stimuli. Some children are susceptible to violence. We know that that's usually between 7 to 11%. So that means 89% are not susceptible to violence. But if you have children, I have 4 children, one of them may be susceptible to hitting the other children. The other one may be susceptible to whining. And the other children may be susceptible to saying nothing happened. There's 31% are susceptible to the sexual messages, about 60% susceptible to the consumerism, to buying products they don't need, to buying, let's say, a pair of sneakers with a Nike symbol on them for much more than they could get a sneaker that it does everything the same way, only without the symbol on it. So we know that there's a variety of, now, just because some children are susceptible to different things, that doesn't mean that they're not. Now, your specific question here is whether seeing the bad can help us to be articulate or prepare us. For one, you have to be careful that children who are in vulnerable stages of development are not exposed to what they can't handle. They cannot be put in a position where they're learning scripts of behavior. Often they won't even tell their parents the scripts of behavior because they don't know how to articulate it until later they start acting out. Number two, if you want to look at, counterfeiting in the United States, and I used to work at the U.S. Attorney's Office, Southern District of New York, when the FBI looks at counterfeiting, they look at genuine bills, and that's the way they recognize the counterfeit, by being so familiar with the genuine. So the best place to start in understanding the counterfeit is to look at the Bible and look at good films, good entertainment, things that build your faith and values, not looking at the opposite. Number three, though, is that quite often people don't understand how movies work on you. And I'll take Angels and Demons as a good example. Not only has the secular press, like the Washington Post, said that it's ponderous and dull, and you know, we have all the things about Tom Hanks did just walk through the film and didn't have to do any action sequences, so you had a hero without a love story and a hero without any action, so you became sort of an observer instead of an actor in the movie. But beside all of that, the hero is the one who's constantly demeaning and putting down faith. The villain is the one who's lifting up faith and saying you have to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ and his spouse. And he's the one who's hired the killer to kill the cardinals. He is the evil, confused person. So, you know, any child in the imagination stage is going to get that point that if they want to be the hero, they've got to be the one who's cynical, who's anti-faith, who's anti-values, who's able to see through the evil blustering of the fundamentalist Christian, who's the actual killer in the film. And the film also puts out a lot of disinformation. For instance, on the UK website for British scientists, they have the 10 myths about science. One of the myths is the myths of Galileo, saying that Galileo was convicted. And if I asked you, and I've done this with radio people, I asked you why Galileo was, under house arrest. He was never, he went to mass every day. He wasn't treated badly. He was best friends with the Pope. But why was he under house arrest? Most people will say because he had a heliocentric view of the universe. And that's not true. So it's listed on the top 10 myths in science by the British Science Society, which doesn't have any reason to defend the church or defend Galileo. Also, the Angels and Demons says that 4 scientists were killed by the church. You cannot find in history a record, and a couple of universities, University of Georgia went after it, University of Illinois went after it. You cannot find 4 scientists. The first scientist you can find that who was killed in any sort of a program was killed during the French Revolution, which was the Reign of Terror, which was anti-Christian, and the biggest group of scientists were killed under Joseph Stalin, which was communism, and you cannot trace directly somebody who was killed because of their scientific investigation. Yet I can talk to people in my church. I pastor a church on weekends in my spare time between Berkeley and this, and people will say, oh, yes, the church was killing scientists. The church was doing this. The church was doing that. So these misconceptions have now turned us into a toxic culture for Christianity because people thought, oh, I understand this. And they're deeper things. I mean, you have people buying into ontological nominalism instead of epistemological realism, and you have them confused on basic issues of theology. And I have a ministry here, and I have people, in the office who are confused on basic issues of theology. One of them is my secretary who goes to movies every week, and she's always coming up with ideas that don't have any reference to reality. That said, some of the people making these movies are Christians. One of the persons I like, who's a screenwriter, who's a very good Christian, wrote Gladiator, and that's sort of a neutral movie that we can talk about. And I said, this is ridiculous in Gladiator because they didn't use the longbow until the Battle of Agincourt. And he said, well, I know, but I'm not doing history. Hmm. I said, well, my daughter was in a very good Christian school, and the teacher at the parent-teacher meeting said, oh, we're using movies to tell people history, and we use Gladiator for history. I said, Gladiator doesn't have any history in it. It misrepresents who Commodus is. It misrepresents what was going on at the time. This is a teacher of history at a private school, which is supposed to be better than the public schools. And you're tearing your hair out, if I hadn't already lost all my hair, saying the people have bought the lie of this movie. Not that the guy was doing this out of malice aforethought. This wasn't like an attack. He just thought it made a good yarn by involving things that didn't have anything to do with the history of Rome at the time. We do this detailed report to the entertainment industry that shows what does well, and many studios have bought into this vision. In fact, in the time that we've been doing the report to the entertainment industry, there are only 6 major studios, and all of them now have Christian divisions. They are now doing, Sony has done extremely well with their Christian division. They did Fireproof, which was made for $500,000 and made $48 million at the box office. So every time they do a film like this, they do better. And you even see big budget films that do nods to faith and values that you wouldn't have seen in the past. For instance, you have Terminator Salvation. And if you don't get the fact that the word salvation is in there, talking about being born again, using that language, talking about how we can have a second chance at life. You have Up, where he goes to church to get married and church for the funeral. You have scenes that lift up positive mentions of Jesus. And I'll give you one direct example. A good friend of mine, Stan Lee, is the founder of Marvel Comics, and we honored one of his movies was in the group that we were honoring for the Epiphany Prize. He didn't make it, But it was the first Spider-Man, because he said, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." They had the whole Lord's Prayer in there. If I kept doing the Lord's Prayer on your radio program, you'd stop me because it would go on too long. And Stan came to our event with his beautiful wife, and he calls me every once in a while, and he said, "Ted, this is so great. I want to win an Epiphany prize. I want to win the $100,000 prize. How do I do that? I'm going to have to put twice as much Christian content in the next movie." So the next movie had two Hail Marys and another Our Father. So I called Stan up and I say, "Stan, I don't think this is what it means to have a Christian worldview in your movie, just because you've happened to put in two nice prayers and another one of the Our Fathers." So, but at least they're being encouraged to do good, and then it gets deeper. I was with the man who produced Passion and Braveheart and everything yesterday, trying to work on how they can do more movies that do better at the box office and capture that audience.
You touched on this a little bit already, but I want you to flesh it out a bit more for me. Why are you so passionate about seeing Christians have an influence in the media?
Well, because I believe the Great Commission, which actually appears five times in the Gospels, not just at the end of Matthew, that you go into all the world to proclaim the gospel, the good news of the salvation that's available in Jesus Christ. I believe that the church has been given by God. Whenever there's been a technological breakthrough, the church is at the forefront. The thing that a couple of years ago, one of the great Catholic theologians, and I don't want to disparage him, wrote a whole article about how the Catholics missed the boat on the Reformation. They lost the impetus to the Protestant church because they didn't embrace the printing press. Instead, they were destroying them, and he said they should have embraced them. That said, there are a lot of these inventions, like, for instance, when Edison invented the motion picture camera, he gave it to William Booth, who started the Salvation Army. In fact, you can still see online some of the, he did about six narrative stories using the motion picture camera, and Edison tried to give the rights to his local presbytery, and the presbytery said, "This is just a toy. Nobody's ever going to watch movies." And then the first radio station was in a church in Pittsburgh, commercial radio station, and the pastor told the assistant pastor that he was wasting his time with it. So, and the first color TV, and the first Farnsworth, who invented the TV, was a Christian. So a lot of these things, Christians have been given these wonderful tools and then said, "We're not going to be responsible for them." And Pope Innocent III, of course, told the medieval church that they shouldn't have mystery plays, which were the great method of bringing people to Christ during the Middle Ages. So the history of the church has always been this love-hate relationship with media, and the media has always been a tool of getting the word out. You're using it now in a very effective way with the radio, and people need to use every media not only to communicate, the Great Commission, but also to be able to delight, inform, to create beauty. God told us in Philippians 4 to look at the beautiful and the true, to create art. God has created us in his image, and his image is one as the creator in Genesis 1, the first passage. His image, he's created us. He is the creator, so we're created in that image. And next, he's to communicate. He is the word in John, so he created us to communicate. So we create and communicate because that's his mandate to us, and it's a good idea to take seriously what he said, and it's a wonderful thing to let God work through you in a way that you can be redemptive in our society.
You put the call out a little earlier for those who are wanting to write a script or have written a script. How about giving us the general advice you've got for those who dream of working in film, as perhaps a director either or an actor? Tell us what you would say to them.
Well, I said this in Santa Fe, and most people don't get it. The most important quality you can have in any of a very competitive field, how competitive is it? Every year, the Writers Guild in the United States gets 300,000 scripts, and there are less than 300 movies released to the box office. That means it's 10,000 to 1. Well, let's say to get into Oxford or Cambridge is about 12 to 1. So that means it's much, much harder than getting into Oxford and Cambridge is to get into the entertainment industry. So I think the first quality you need, beside the God-given talent that God has given you, is humility. You need humility to learn your craft. You need humility to listen to others. Pixar is a good example. The Pixar rule is if anybody doesn't in their staff does not like, and they show it for the whole, you know, a couple hundred people who work at Pixar, if anybody doesn't like their film, they tear it apart. And they've kept their word. With Toy Story 1, that wasn't working when it came out. So 6 months out, they started to repair it. They spent millions of dollars repairing it. If you read the Pixar Touch, it'll tell you that they really care enough to make sure that their films work. And I wish I could see. I get a lot of people calling me and saying, you know, God told me to write a script. And I said, well, God didn't tell me to read your script. And, you know, sometimes the scripts are just awful. Learn your craft. And So You Want to Be in Pictures is just the start. There's some good teaching out there. Go to movieguide.org. You can find out a lot more about it. Movieguide.org is a good place to start. But there are a lot of good places to start. And there are good programs like Act One here in the United States and what you're doing over there in Sydney. So people need to get into a group. The Inklings, where C.S. Lewis honed his craft and Tolkien owned his craft, is bring the smartest people you can together to work on perfecting what you're doing and be humble enough not to take umbrage when people start telling you that you need to improve the quality of your writing.
Dr. Ted Baer from movieguide.org, thank you so much for talking to us on Open House.
Oh, it's been wonderful. Great questions, and I'm impressed. So have a wonderful day.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.